For KOSU News, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Oklahoma comes to a settlement with one of the drug makers facing a lawsuit over opioids. Purdue Pharma, maker of OxyContin, is paying $270 million to the state, with the lion's share of the money going to Oklahoma State's Health Center in Tulsa to focus on addiction research. There are still other opioid companies facing a trial at the end of next month. Ryan, what do you think of this settlement?
I think it's huge. It's historic. I mean, when you look at the context, I mean, we're very close to the trial date. The Oklahoma State Supreme Court had rejected an attempt to delay the trial. And then there's the context of, you know, potential bankruptcy with Purdue. And, you know, I think that the state saw that there was an opportunity to get a secured settlement to protect itself from bankruptcy and to ensure that the state of Oklahoma would ultimately receive money. A settlement is always better, or generally better, than a trial verdict, because a trial verdict could be appealed. Then you've got bankruptcy, and then you're in line behind other secured creditors. This guarantees the state of Oklahoma is going to receive the lion's share of that $270 million. And this is only the first step. I think that it's going to have huge regional, if not nationwide, implications. It's going to have some spillover effect into litigation, federal litigation around the country. A huge congratulations to the Attorney General, to my good friends Judge Mike Burridge and Reggie Witten, some of the private counsel that have been cooperating and leading this really historic first in the nation settlement of its kind. And I think that we could possibly see some other settlements before that trial date comes up.
Neva.
I think that's right. I mean, it's a new day in Oklahoma, as the Attorney General said, and really for the country in the battle against addiction and the opioid epidemic. And I think when you look at this, you're right, Ryan. I mean, there are 35 states, hundreds of municipalities with litigation pending. So the fact that we as a state were able to get this settlement now and move forward is monumental. And I think the other aspect of this is it sets the stage for this company with the next set of cases looming, later this year in the fall, 1,600 cases that have been consolidated in Ohio that'll be before a Cleveland federal judge. It just makes this all the more significant. So I think when you look at this, you look at the breakout of how the settlement was itemized, it's a win-win-win across the board for Oklahomans. And more importantly, it begins to really address this epidemic that, as was mentioned in the case in the court filings that Oklahoma had put forward, that we are we lead the nation in non-medical use of painkillers. This is an epidemic in our state that really is long overdue being addressed. And the fact that even in 2015 we had over 800 deaths related to the addiction issue. So I think that I applaud also, as you have said, Ryan, Attorney General Hunter, and all of those that have been involved. Certainly there will be questions that will start to come forward. We're already seeing that from lawmakers questioning whether, how should this have been directed? Were they in the position to direct it all to one university versus multiple universities, and on the story goes. But the upshot for this week is it's a national news story that has strong implications for a positive result for Oklahomans.
And a pretty good idea for Attorney General Mike Hunter to not join in this class action lawsuit of other states.
Yeah, well, and the way that we structured our lawsuit here in Oklahoma, we had even though there were more defendants here, they were limited to manufacturers. And so we didn't have this huge sprawling class action that dealt with distributors, pharmacy companies, dispensaries. This was a manufacturer-based lawsuit. I think that, there is some heartburn over the fact that the Sackler family here may seem to be getting off because, they get to pay the settlement and walk away. When they walked into that trial, if they walked into that courtroom in Norman, Oklahoma, there are going to be video cameras in that courtroom. It was going to be televised. Everybody was going to see it. And there was some really damning evidence. Now, the Attorney General had a real choice to make, and the counsel had a real choice to make. Do we take this money and invest it moving forward in the state of Oklahoma, or do we take this opportunity to really, humiliate and punish this family? And I think that we got a little of both here. And if we had gone into that trial, and even if we'd got a judgment, we couldn't have guaranteed that we would have this huge settlement and this huge investment in an opioid treatment in the state of Oklahoma and across the country.
And you're right. The Sackler family, I mean, they are kind of in the bullseye right now. I mean, the House Oversight Committee just recently asked the company to turn over many documents related to the family and their role in the company's marketing. So, I mean, this is an ongoing, big picture look at what still has hundreds, if not thousands, of lawsuits that still will ensue across the country related to this very matter.
The leader of the state Senate forms a working group to look into cost of living adjustments, also known as COLAs, for state retirees. This comes as the Senate is getting a House bill offering a 4% COLA to former state workers. Neva, does this stall the process of giving a COLA to retirees this year?
Well, I think the question is, listening to what Senate Pro Tem Treat said, I mean, it looks like he's slowing the train down on this. It went through the House, obviously, very quickly and easily. But the question is, there's been no actuarial study. There's no information really on the financial impact of this. I mean, granted, everyone recognizes and acknowledges that these folks in these pension programs deserve a cost of living adjustment. This is something that has been a long time coming now. But the bigger question is, how do we adjust and pay for it? So I think it will be interesting to see what the Senate ultimately does. But it very well may be, you know, that they will either slow it down to the point that nothing happens this year, they come back next year, or perhaps they send the volley back to the House and say instead of 4%, 2% or some other number. So it's a moving target right now, but clearly going to be part of this ongoing conversation through the end of session.
Ryan.
The Oklahoma Public Employees Association, the real driving lobby behind the effort to increase the cost of living benefit for Oklahoma's retirees. We're talking about school teachers, firefighters, the folks that have this guaranteed to them. The last time that they got a cost of living adjustment was in 2008. So we're over a decade past now. Inflation has swallowed up a lot of their retirement checks. There are some folks that are reporting that their retirement check is entirely consumed by their insurance check. And so, you know, they're just living paycheck to paycheck, and even then coming out in the red. And so I think that when you look at where the Oklahoma Public Employees Association started out this session, they were asking for an 8% increase. There was initially an offer of a 2% increase. The House bill started, got us to a 4% increase. And there's, if you look at where I think that there is the question of what that 4% increase would look like to the pension funds, but our pension funds right now are healthier than they've ever been. And I think that when we can look and say, firefighters, I think, are at 68%, teachers are at 72%. Morningstar says that around 70% solvency is kind of the benchmark for a healthy pension fund. So we're right around there. And that's a real improvement from where we've been in years past. So I think that we're at a point where we've built those pension funds up to a healthy spot. A cost of living adjustment is due, and it looks like we can afford it. It is a question, I think, as Neva said, is what it will ultimately be. Even if this bill stalls before committee deadline, if leadership wants there to be a cost of living adjustment, that can happen at some time before the legislature adjourns in May.
That's all in budget. They could also go back and just decide that one. The number of issues at county jails appears to be rising. Nevada County's sheriff resigns over issues at the jail there. A lawsuit levels accusations against Washington County, calling it a debtor's prison, and a second lost inmate shown up in the Oklahoma County Jail. Ryan, what's going on here?
Well, what's going on is that we're seeing the results of decades of failed criminal justice policy in the state of Oklahoma, and largely shouldered by counties in the state of Oklahoma. And so when you talked about the second lost inmate, that second lost inmate in Oklahoma County Jail, she was picked up on a warrant that had been revoked. She wasn't even supposed to be picked up. She gets picked up, arrested for a warrant that a judge had discharged. She goes in and gets lost in the system. We have people lost in the system for months. You're talking about two individuals. By the end of this week, if not the end of next week, I suspect that reported number will be over 10 individuals that have been lost in the Oklahoma County jail system. And it's not just Oklahoma County, it's all 77 of Oklahoma's counties. And we were talking about this beforehand. And so for our listeners, jail and prison are different. Prison is where you go after you've been convicted of crime. The overwhelming number of people sitting in county jails right now are innocent. They've been charged with a crime and they can't bail or bond out. They can't afford to go home to their families and their jobs. And so they're stuck there, but they are as innocent as you and me walking around. That's the presumption of innocence. That's the bedrock of the American criminal justice system. And far too many people end up in jail before they ever go to trial. So when you're driving around, if you're in Oklahoma County and you look at that county jail, or if you're in Wewoka and you're looking at the Seminole County Jail, know that the overwhelming number of folks in there, 80, 90% of the people that are subject to dehumanizing conditions, are there, they are presumed innocent.
Neva.
I mean, it is such a deplorable situation. I mean, in this Nowata County jail situation, where, I mean, it becomes not only national news but international news this week. I mean, when you have a newly elected sheriff who resigns basically in a confrontation with a judge who is saying, "I'm going to hold you in contempt if you don't do X, Y, Z," and virtually all of the rest of the staff leaving, including the K-9 who gave his paw resignation, I guess paw print resignation, as she said. I mean, you've got a difficult situation that is systemic in the state of Oklahoma. Nowata is one of the poorest. It's, I think, the third poorest county in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. You have a county with $1 million budget. You're trying to incarcerate in jail maybe 10 or 12 inmates, and yet what really came to light was the deplorable conditions that the jail, which is in a building that's almost 100 years old, I mean, all of these problems that everyone has kind of kicked the can down the road acknowledging but no one wanting to address. But when you have exposed wires and shower areas and you have widespread mold, you have plumbing issues, you have methane escaping into the jail building, snakes falling out. I mean, it's like something out of a bad movie script, and it's something that's got to be remedied. But again, about the time you think one place has kind of begun to get a handle on something, you find, six more examples in other counties of this very same thing. So Oklahoma County obviously continues to be at the forefront just in the discussion. It's escalated by the sheriff and a county commissioner now engaging in a kind of a war of words. But the bottom line is we've got to get past these just back and forth discussions or diatribes and move to some real resolution. I mean, in Oklahoma County, I mean, a county that built a jail that basically many say was obsolete the day the doors opened in terms of the way it was constructed and the way that it can be operated, and now we just continue to acknowledge it's a problem without trying to find a solution. So it is a big problem in Oklahoma, and we can't just talk about it. We've got to systematically go about finding solutions.
How do you see it? How do you fix this?
Well, number one, most of those people in those jails don't need to be in those jails. I mean, that's it. They're there
but
pre-trial.
But they're also making money for the county.
Absolutely, they're making money for the county. And the bail bonds lobby is incredibly powerful. They're making money out of this. You've got private phone operators that are making money out of this. You've got, county sheriffs that want to justify increasing maintaining the number of folks on their payroll. I mean, we can talk about the design of the Oklahoma County Jail, and it's awful. Trust me, I've been there. It is terrible. And, all day long we can talk about it, but at the end of the day, it's systems that put people in that jail. I mean, just to kind of illustrate how terrible things are, Nowata County, they refused to put their inmates back there and were pretrial detainees, put them back in that jail because of all of these problems. They transferred them to Washington County. Washington County is the county now that's being sued for running a debtor's prison. And again, that's one of the things that drives folks in, is that we put these fines and fees on people that they can't pay, that regular people can't pay, but you throw somebody in the criminal justice system that's probably dealing with poverty, dealing with substance abuse, mental health issues. Those are a higher risk for that population anyways. And then you put these fines and fees on them, and you take as much money out of them as you can get, and then eventually they don't have any money left to give, and you throw them in jail. And so we move people from Nowata County, where they've got snakes and exposed wires, over to Washington County, that's a debtor's prison.
You've also got to have a situation, though, where all parties come to the table. It can't be the either-or. Law enforcement on one side, advocates on the other side trying to move another direction with reform. I mean, at some point, everyone has to come to the table and find some middle ground. And I think that's what's exacerbating this situation, is the unwillingness for that to happen in some sort of systematic fashion. So, I think there have been efforts, but they seem to move a few inches and then they fall backwards. And so I think we're at a place where there needs to be some real assertive leadership on the part of folks at every level of this discussion and problem to really see that what happens is good for Oklahomans, because you're right, Ryan. We don't need these stories continuing to bubble up over and over and over again and continue to not really address the underlying problems that that are creating it.
But now, you know, we've got a sheriff or a former sheriff in Nowata County, and that's where I think that this conversation's really starting to change, because it's law enforcement driving this conversation. ACLU, we've been on here talking about abysmal dehumanizing conditions in county jails for years. But whenever you have a county sheriff saying, I won't go to work there, I won't send my deputies to work there, it's not safe enough for the public servants, for these law enforcement public servants to even walk in and go to work there. You know, that I think is a real game changer in this conversation. So jails, pretrial detainees, before you've been convicted. Prison is where you go after you've been convicted of a crime.
McAllister.
Yeah, McAllister. Granted.
One of the state's largest agencies says it needs more money to pay its bills. The Office of Management and Enterprise Services says it's behind on payments on some of bills up to 60 days past due. Officials warn if it doesn't get a $16 million supplemental, other state services could suffer. Neva, do you think OMES is going to get its supplement?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the agency said it needed $7 million by Monday, April 1st, just to avoid some serious disruptions in services. But you have the Senate Appropriations Chair basically saying, you know, I think the money is probably there, at least this initial, whether it's in revolving funds or wherever it is. And I don't think there's any enthusiasm on the part of the legislature to come back to a situation like the Health Department 2.0 kind of a situation where, oh, we need this money. Oh, well, after the fact, maybe we didn't need as much or didn't need it. Did not need it at all. So I think we're at a place where they're trying to sort through it. There seems to be discussion going on that may in fact get all of the information to a place where they find actually what they need. I don't think it's not that anyone's interested in shutting down agencies. It's more about figuring out what we do, not only short term, but you know, as Senator Thompson has talked about, really looking at this. One of the bills that he has this session is breaking out the IT part in OMES, and that is a huge component of this overall situation, and perhaps even some of the monies that are being talked about now as being a shortfall. So, or shortfall at least in the estimation of they think they need it now, as opposed to waiting and not having a supplemental.
Ryan, the OMES, one of the largest agencies, was created only a few years ago to consolidate. Now they're talking about splitting it up.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and when just a few years ago, back in 2012, so in 2012, it was when OMES was passed. Back in, I think, 2009, Governor Henry appointed the first CI, Chief Information Officer, at then the Office of State Finance. And so OMES was then created in 2012 as a further, even more bold reorganization effort. And it was this idea of consolidating information and technology, creating efficiencies, eliminating redundancies within state agency, trying to, you know, put together purchasing power for the state of Oklahoma. And now we're in this situation of saying, well, wait a second, did we create an organization that's too big to actually accomplish its mission for these state agencies? And so in an effort to create efficiencies, maybe the state of Oklahoma has now created some inefficiencies. And, you know, that's, you know, what I think is going to be important here is to really look and say, you know, what part of the OMES restructuring in 2012, what part of the consolidation of information and technology that, you know, happened while I was there in 2009, 2010, you know, what part of that is now not working? And, you know, did we move too fast on this and create a system that, you know, now can't hold its own weight?
Well, and it may be just the changing focus in this new administration, the new kind of restructuring and the move across the board in government. When you look at IT, digital technology, all of the things that are being talked about by the state administration, it's about finding big savings. I mean, even just this past week, the new cabinet secretary saying that he believes that there's $1 billion in savings out there that can be the result of just innovative digital technology moving in that direction. So IT, when you look at that in the grouping at OMES, when you think about budgeting, purchasing, human resources, HR, those things, they seem to fit together, at least in my mind. But this IT component very well may need to be extracted out, just so there can be, when we're talking of tens of millions of dollars and a focus that is going to go across all agencies, ultimately it may be to have a real pulse on what's going on and be able to really manage that well and not have this continued problem of not enough enough money moving fast and trying to get some real results, it may make sense.
And you also have to think of the leadership. Before this year, it was actually run by Preston Dorflinger, who also got into trouble by running the State Department of Health.
So and he left and Denise Northrup, took his place.
Yeah, and we're talking about an information technology consolidation that happened over a decade ago. I mean, these things and these systems have improved, light years since we first started working on this over a decade ago in the state. So, reviewing it and seeing whether it's still worthwhile or not is, something the legislature should do.
This week marks 1 year since the lawmakers passed an historic tax increase to pay for teacher raises and other education needs. House Bill 1010XX was signed by Governor Fallon. Ryan, your thoughts on the one-year anniversary of the teacher pay increase bill?
I mean, it's hard to believe that it's been a year. I mean, you go to the Capitol right now, and it's a totally different world than where we were a year ago out at the Capitol with the teacher walkout. And I think that one of the things that happened was there was this sea change in attitudes towards revenue in the state of Oklahoma and at the state Capitol. We still don't have a legislature that's tripping over itself to raise the kind of revenue that we actually need to run the state of Oklahoma, but I think enough lawmakers realized that at some point, and I think a lot of this was the Republican majority, that they had been running a political game for years to get into the majority, but it took them a while to realize, hey, wait a second, we are in the majority, now we actually have to govern and run this state, and we either run it into the ground or we begin to make some investments in things that we care about, like education. And so you saw some Republicans and in leadership say, we're going to do this. They passed these tax cuts with overwhelming Democratic support, a big support from the tax increases, passed those, and the Democratic caucus came along and supported that as well and really drove that issue and got more than I think the Republicans would have been comfortable to do at all. And then the elections happened. And the people that lost elections were people that opposed those revenue increases, people that supported them. Nobody paid a price at the polls for supporting revenue increases. And I think that set a tone for this legislative session. They also seem a little, with newer folks out there that came in the wake of the revenue increases last year, there's, I think, a little bit more sober attitude towards governing right now at the Capitol. And I say that and everything could fall apart next week, but this session just seems different than it has in years past.
Neva.
Well, and I think the question is, will it fall apart when we really start talking about how we pay for all of the things that we're talking about? The House, in the bills that they passed out, I mean, the number is somewhere $130+ million in actual reductions. I mean, where they took away, they decreased fees, they took away negative revenue bills. I mean, when you look at them. So, I mean, you look at that and then you look at these the eight or more House bills that passed out that were education related, a lot of them have a new price tag on them. So, I mean, when those go to the Senate side now, I think that's where the rubber meets the road in terms of, the Senate now looking at these bills and saying, yes, that's great. You had almost unanimous bipartisan support on your side. But at some point, we've all got to come back to the table and figure out how much is this costing and where is the money? And does that mean that there's some appetite to take all of this money out of the rainy day or do X, Y, Z to get there? I think that's where the rub's going to be. So I think that there's a profound interest on the part of lawmakers to continue to move the needle where education is concerned. And I think they've made some, in some of the measures that came out of the House, there are some pretty significant changes that clearly are on the table. The question is how many of them make it to the finish line based upon the total picture of what we need to continue to operate state government across the board.
And, I think in years past, walking into those final weeks of the budget negotiations, before last year, I would say that the fee decreases, the things that cut revenue from the state of Oklahoma, that those would have walked in with a greater probability of succeeding than things that invested in increased spending. I don't want to say that the investments now have an edge, but it's much more of a level playing field walking into those negotiations than it has been in years past. It's still going to be a tough sell to say we're not going to cut this fee or eliminate this fee, but the political balancing act now, I think people realize that investments in education get you more political bang for your buck than reducing a fee or a license.
And not just education, but several different states.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're talking about jails. We're talking about everything else that needs to be paid for as well.
But when you have these one-time incentives of $5,000 to get certified teachers come back to the classroom, when you the $1,200 across-the-board teacher pay raise, the $1,000 tax credit for teachers, you know, buying supplies, you know, for their classroom, on and on, all of those, as you begin to look at them, all of them do have a budget implication. So I think that's what we're going to have to see: is there going to be a little, is there going to be trimming, or is there going to be eliminating, or is there going to be let's come back next year and talk this over some more?
And I think the governor and the legislature are more reluctant than ever to use one-time funds. So, you know, rainy day money, I
would agree.
I don't think that that's really on the table.
I think that's going to be a hard sell, particularly in the governor's office, if not with most lawmakers.
Yep. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.